You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. If you've been listening to the show regularly, you know that we've done a series of special episodes on Roman history and political thought, beginning with the monarchy and stretching all the way down through the end of the empire when we finally get around to recording that far. And what you'll have noticed is that along the way, we've mentioned several times a philosopher, historian, I'm not sure exactly where to fit him, a writer named Charles Norris Cochran in his book, Christianity and Classical Culture. And if you've further gone out and picked up a copy of that book and read it, you've almost certainly wanted to read more from him and then been frustrated because there is nothing else currently in print until now. A new book has been released called Augustine and the Problem of Power. This is a selection of the essays and lectures of Charles Norris Cochran, edited by David Beer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Malone University. He is joining us today on the phone. Dr. Beer, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, you are you teach political science at Malone. You live in Canton with your wife and your four kids and attend St. John's Anglican. Is there any other biographical stuff you want out there in the World Wide Web?
I'm also the associate director of our Center for Christian Faith and Culture at Malone University.
Okay. And what do you do in that role?
So we're trying to, engage the wider community as well as the university with, the broad spectrum and tradition of mere Christianity, as an ecumenical school that doesn't have just one faith tradition represented in either our faculty or our students. We're trying to be a voice for orthodoxy and to bring in good speakers and, great ideas from the tradition and expose our students to those, as well as serve as a resource for churches and pastors in the area, as well as kind of a sort of continuing education for the community in the faith.
Which is something that fits in pretty well with what's going on in this book. So I guess we should ask first, who is Charles Norris Cochran? Who was Charles Norris Cochran and why does he matter?
Yeah, so he's unfortunately, kind of still has a reputation as a great figure, and many people still stumble upon his work. But for most people, it's sort of that's it. They don't really know much about him. He was a classicist and a historian who taught at the University of Toronto from 1913 until his somewhat early death in 1945. And he published Christianity and Classical Culture, which remains in print to this day. During his life, right after his death, was translated into many languages. And so it's a widely regarded book that I think particularly is also really, really helpful for Christians looking at the period of late antiquity and sort of the transition from the classical and Roman period into the Middle Ages. And so he was this just profound scholar who unfortunately died without having published anything. Published his sort of follow-up projects until I was able to bring out this text of his posthumous writings.
Now there is a book out there, although I don't think it's in print, by him on Thucydides, right?
So Thucydides and the Science of History, published in 1929, and in many ways that is still has some good pieces of the book, though not as many people are focusing on Thucydides as sort of a research topic, and he's not as clear in that text about some of his motivations as far as, say, Christian faith go and things like that. So it's still a wonderful, book in some ways. And I'm hoping to, bring more people to that book by providing context to it in some of my future writings.
Although it's not in print right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe through the, you know, the print-on-demand world that we sort of exist in now, maybe somebody might be able to do it. But no, it's not currently in print, as I understand it.
Right. Yeah, I keep every once in a while I check in to see if there's an affordable used copy. And every time I search for it on Amazon, I get a book by another classicist named Cornford called Thucydides, what's the name, Mithyristicus or something like that. So there are books out there with similar titles, but don't be fooled. It's not yet available easily. But his main book is, as you say, is Christianity and Classical Culture. Now that's not the book we're talking about today exactly. But can you give us just a short overview of what's going on in that book and why it matters?
Yeah, in a lot of ways it's his magnum opus, so it's perfectly fine to talk about that. And I always tell people that it's a fantastic book to read, and so I don't want to sort of claim any exclusivity for Augustine and the Problem of Power. But Christian classical culture is about the transition that happens in philosophy and in politics with the advent of Christianity. In many ways, in many actually important and definitive ways, the classical world was broken, and Greek philosophy had sort of reached an impasse, and certainly the politics of the period were in turmoil. And so, Christianity was a really appealing alternative for a lot of people, and it really easily became a dominant worldview in the period, because everything else was sort of bankrupt intellectually. And he's really good, and that's why he's still referred to often, and people still find value in it, because he does such an excellent job of demonstrating sort of the bankruptcy that had arisen during this time as an explanation for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It's not just a matter of, say, economics or, warfare or something like that. A lot of other people who've looked at the decline and fall historically have sort of been too reductionistic in trying to point out the problems that may have contributed. And he, while acknowledging all those problems as an issue, is much better about demonstrating that it was actually a problem of understanding, or sort of philosophy, worldview, we might say, that contributed definitively to, the downfall of the classical period.
Right. It's basically the argument that this collapse was going to happen regardless of any given particular cause, right? Barbarian invasions, or economic inflation, or whatever. It was built into the structure of classical civilization because of the foundational ideas that were held by basically everyone in the ancient world, right? Philosophers, political figures, generals, artists, playwrights, and so on.
And that's why he focuses at the beginning of the book, right, on Augustus, right. And as an emperor who thought he was actually, drawing on the best of the classical tradition, and that he had really solved the problems and was going to, put Rome on a firm foundation again after the civil and social wars, and that everything was going to sort of be better now. And so you can really the best way to understand Christian classical culture is by looking at the three-part argument of the three sections of the book. And so it moves from reconstruction to renovation to regeneration. Augustus is in this period of reconstruction where they think they're actually they think that they're actually solving the problems for once and for all, and it's a permanent solution, right? Rome will live forever, but they're really just reconstructing a worldview, a philosophy, and a politics, and it really doesn't work. It does break down. Because it, as you say, it was going to necessarily, in the renovation period, he's looking at the early conversion of people like, say, Constantine, where they think that Christianity is a new idea. They recognize that, but that they sort of assume too much for it because they're still thinking as Romans and as classically educated people. And so thinking that sort of Christianity exists and it's great for political purposes. And so that, Constantine can save the empire by using Christianity. So if it's sort of a using religion as opposed to, fully faithful submission to religion. Cochrane is great because, he's at the sort of leading edge of in the mid-century when we recovered Augustine in scholarship. There had been a long-standing neglect of Augustine, and he wasn't considered as important or anything like that. And in that regeneration period, he really reasserts the Augustinian perspective, and talking about the city of God is the place of regeneration, and that political aspirations aren't going to actually save us. So that's sort of a broad overview of Christianity and classical culture, and it's really relevant as well for his other writings. But that's a broad overview.
Right, and relevant for today as well, right? And this is getting into the collection that you've edited, but he points out that some of the assumptions that were built into the classical world are assumptions that we have reassumed, retaken upon ourselves, especially in the wake of the Enlightenment, which we should get into your book. Well, first of all, can you give us just a quick overview of the essays and lectures that you've included in this? And then I think we'll probably want to focus on the main one in it. But can you tell us just briefly about the contents of this volume?
Yeah, so Augustine and the Problem of Power, so the seed of this really is in 1945, he delivered the Nathaniel Taylor lectures at Yale Divinity School. Under that title, and he thought of it as a sort of follow up and a sequel, or at least the foundation for a follow up and sequel to Christian classical culture, and so delivered these named lecture series. He was actually sharing billing at Yale with Reinhold Niebuhr, who was lecturing on alternative evenings, actually. Unfortunately, almost as soon as he returned from Yale, he had a heart attack. And that severely, crippled him, and he died somewhat later. And so there was never a possibility or a real good chance to publish his lectures after he had died, and they actually languished in the possession of his son for a long time. And so that's really the core, and that's what the title. But to really as a way to give people really an accessible entrance into Cochrane's thought. That's really kind of the main strength of this book, is that Christian and classical culture is a magisterial work, but it's a heavy text. It's over 500 pages, and it gets into the weeds a lot on ancient Greece and Rome, particularly Rome. And so it's not necessarily accessible always for the general reader or layman. And so this text is a much more accessible entrance into Cochrane's thought. So as well as Augustine and the Problem of Power, that four-part lecture series, it also has some of his writings on the Latin spirit and literature, and then a couple of what were supposed to be early chapters that had to be cut from Christian classical culture for the sake of space, talking about Roman politics, things like the idea of the Commonwealth and Pax Romana and Caesarism. And then I also included a monograph that he wrote on Machiavelli, and a phenomenal two-part article that he published, but that is largely neglected because it's hard to find these days, on the mind of Edward Gibbon. So that's sort of the broad overview of this text.
Yeah, and I'll echo your praise of that essay. I think all of the essays in this book, essays and lectures, are excellent, but that those two on Gibbon are especially good, and I'm saying that as someone who loves Gibbon, but Cochrane, I think, gets him right and gives a good analysis. Although I will push back just a little bit. I will agree with you that the four lectures, Augustine and the Problem of Power, are more accessible in that they are shorter. I don't know that I agree that they are less dense than the book.
They are challenging, but I think in a worthy kind of manner. I don't think they're challenging in a way that oftentimes scholars write to puff themselves up and demonstrate their understanding over the common average reader. I think they are thoughtful and deep. And so I highly suggest everybody reread them over and over and over again. But yeah, accessible in some sense is a practical term in this case, because they're not 500 pages long.
Right. Right. Well, let's dig into those a little bit, and if we have time, maybe we'll get some of the other essays. But what is the problem of power that that either Cochrane or Augustine or both are trying to solve?
Yeah. So, you know, before I kind of answer that question, the other reason that Cochrane is still sort of worthwhile is you have to remember his historical context, in terms of this is someone who, you know, lived through two world wars. And the Great Depression, and so is seeing confusion and disorder and some, you know, amount of despair in his lifetime, and, you know, particularly in response to, you know, the pretensions that had often animated the period, right? I mean, if you think about things like the social gospel movement, you know, before World War I, you know, there really was an idea that we're going to be, you know, realizing, you know, heaven on earth, through our activities now, because, you know, the world is now, everything's getting better and we've got scientific advancement that can make sense of things. And, you know, for many people, this was, you know, shocking and cataclysmic to go through these, you know, tumultuous events of the 20th century. And so, you know, when he says the problem of power, what you could use the word order, instead. That's the problem of order. You know, politics, government, right, exists as a way of, you know, holding communities together and making life possible. And, you know, the kind of the problem is that when it's working, you take it for granted, so you don't think about it. When things start to go badly, you start to wonder, wait, why is it going badly and how can we find answers? And so that's certainly what, you know, many people were struggling with, not only in the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire, but, you know, in Cochrane's own day as well. So the problem of power is one of order. How can we have freedom, right, and security? How can we have safety in our lives? And it's important. What the superiority of Cochrane to a lot of other people is that he has a firm grasp of political theology as well, and he realizes that the political desire for order and safety is really just a secularized version of the desire for salvation. And so he's more attuned to those things and more helpful for us thinking through a lot of these issues.
And why does order or power or whatever word we want to use there, why does it always go wrong? Why is it that whatever structure we have set up ends up either just decaying and falling apart or being actively abused, at least according to Cochrane/Augustine?
Right. So this is, you know, Augustine's basic point and why the revival of him was so important, right, is in reality, right, all power comes from on high, right? God is the author, right, of real all power. And we are, right, given limited, you know, ends that we should be pursuing in life. But as I was kind of mentioning about the political theology lens, we always, right, end up absolutizing relatives, Cochrane would say, that we think the order and safety that we can provide in politics is definitive and that it's actually offering, you know, a form of salvation for ourselves. So we end up always, you know, having it decay because we're not God. And yet we think we are. We end up committing idolatry, right? And focusing on the state as either you know, a form of God that will save us, or the politicians and statesmen think of themselves that way and lord it over us. So one way or the other, there's going to necessarily be a breakdown, which is the necessity of the Augustinian perspective being, you know, being held in mind at all times.
Yeah, and in these essays and in the larger book as well, Cochrane draws an interesting contrast, isn't quite the right word for it, but an interesting comparison, I guess, point of conflict between Augustine and then basically everyone else, right? Either the classical world or modern secular thinkers, where on the one hand you have Augustine and his doctrine of the will, particularly the will as it is wrapped up in faith, in faith, particularly in the Christian gospel. And on the other side, a doctrine of nature and reason. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that contrast a little bit? Because that I've heard things along those lines before, but never in quite the way Cochrane puts it.
So, I mean, the important thing, and I think you know, what's also fantastic about Cochrane is how he's understanding and making clear that, you know, one of the important things about will is that it, one, gives us personality, right? It gives us our individual identity and uniqueness and worthiness. And that also is what, you know, creates our freedom within history, that we are expressing our wills, that we are creating things, that we are responsible for our choices. And this is really a foreign idea to the classical period, right? They don't have a firm understanding of the will. I mean, you think about something like, you know, Socrates, Plato, saying that, it's ignorance that produces wrongdoing, and that to know the good would be to do the good. And, you know, and compare that to, you know, Pauline and Augustinian Christianity, which would emphasize, right, the good that I know I do not do. And so, you know, without having an understanding of the will, there was, you know, kind of over-reliance on either sort of a rationalist approach saying that, you know, to know the good would be to do it, or focusing on some form of, you know, naturalism or something like that, that we're just necessarily somewhat determined, and so going through motions that have been ordained for us by nature or some other, you know, kind of force. And, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about with the breakdown of classicism comes because these are really unsatisfying answers. You know, in Plato, I mean, I love Plato. But you know, you always run up into things where you kind of think through all the implications of something. You say, well, reason can't actually take us that far. You know, if nothing else, as an example of this, think about the parable of the cave. You know, when the philosopher is freed from the cave, all the verbs in Plato are passive. I mean, how is this person being freed? Plato doesn't say, he just is. He is freed, is turned, is dragged, and everything's passive. Now a Christian can understand that and say conversion, and, you know, grace of God at work. But that's not an answer that's really able to, you know, to be given by Plato. And so, you know, right, there's an impasse and a breakdown. And in this case, you know, the case of, you know, a determinism, you know, it runs into a problem of evil then, right? Why does evil happen? And if it's determined and I was going to do it, then I'm not at fault for it, right? So there's no moral culpability. And so that, once again, kind of a breakdown, that Cochrane gives a superior, Cochrane points to Christianity's superior answer, to these problems that were being confronted.
And for the person who's listening to this, who's not read Cochrane, this is going to sound like a strange conversation about Augustine, right? Because when I think Augustine, either sort of whatever popular view there is of him, or even having read, for people who've read some, our first thought usually isn't going to be free will and counter-determinism, right? Isn't he the big predestination guy? Isn't he the big, you know, grace guy that you know, John Calvin will later build off of? So in what way is the will being used here?
All right. So the will, what he's emphasizing, right, is that, I mean, he would point out that, right, Augustine doesn't think you have a free will, that you have will, right? That there's actually a difference, right? The free will kind of implies that I'm completely free to choose indiscriminately between two choices. And, you know, Augustine would not hold that. Really what we deal with is sort of a form of bondage, really. We have salutary bondage being, right, you know, tied to the good, or we have it, right, as unsalutary being chained to evil, right? I mean, if you think about in the Confessions, if you say use the Pine Coffin translation, you know, when he talks about his childhood, he talks about his truant freedom, that, you know, desperately wanted to do bad things. And it really wasn't freedom. It was actually, you know, doing bad things, that freedom is doing good things. So the will is, you know, he's demonstrating that, and he's so good on this, is that, you know, the real freedom comes from accepting something first, right? That faith does determine some things, but that amount of determination frees you up to do all kinds of other things. So, you know, I focus on, I think it's more of a kind of a Lutheran term, but that salutary bondage is you are free and unfree. You are, right, unfree in this little thing that you didn't choose all these things. But once you submit to grace and submit to God, all this other freedom opens up. And I think a lot of people, you're right, misunderstand that because they kind of focus on double predestination and how can this be fair and things like that without really actually plumbing the depths of Augustine on the will.
Yeah, and related to that, the other side of what Cochrane says in these essays, Augustine's contribution is his doctrine of original sin.
Yeah.
So what role does that play in his revaluation of politics, particularly in contrast again to the classical and then the modern worldviews?
So on the one hand, right, it's really important to understand that original sin was crucial for the classical world in giving an explanation for why things weren't the way they were supposed to be, right? Why there's brokenness. So, you know, once again, going back to Plato's Allegory of the Cave, which I assume that, you know, there's a general sort of, knowledge about that among your audience. The idea, you know, behind the cave is that we're actually not participating in reality. We all know that something's wrong, right? Fast forward into modern culture and you think about something like The Matrix, right? And your choice between a red pill and a blue pill. Everybody knows there's something, we realize something's not right.
We've just shown our age here, by the way.
Yeah, sorry about that. This assumption that there's something not right in the world is profoundly common among human experience, but classicism had no good answer for it. And Christianity has saying original sin explains why things are broken. Right. Even though that's not the way they were meant to be, was, you know, really a revelation for the classical world. However, I do want to caution, right, part of my what really drew me to Cochrane originally, I've been reading Cochrane for a long time, what really drew me to him originally was how good he is on grace. Because particularly for those of us who, you know, kind of know our Augustine or read him, many people just approach him simply as another political realist, not that different from, say, you know, Hobbes or somebody like that. Like, he just focuses on how bad things are, right? And in a lot of ways, it's important for us to emphasize that, right, people are broken, the world is sinful. Don't be an idealist who thinks everything's going to be wonderful. The problem has become, though, that that's taken to be Augustine's only contribution, is that all he can do is say that the world is broken. And so I'm always concerned that people are foreshortening and alighting the conversation by only talking about original sin without also talking about grace. You have to have both parts of those both of those things in your conversation to actually make sense of either of them. You have to understand sin to understand grace, but consequently, you also to understand grace have to understand sin. They go back and forth. And so, yes, original sin, profoundly important for politics. But I think that most people tend to accept that, right? People tend to look around the world and see that things aren't what they're supposed to be. But so you necessarily kind of sometimes have to emphasize the conversation about grace, which I think that Cochrane is so good on.
Right. And that, I hate to use the word dualism because it's sort of a loaded term, but that dualism is something that is fairly unique to Christianity, again, particularly in contrast with ancient philosophies where even if that's not what you want to do, ultimately the ancient philosophies end up either saying the world is all bad or it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's not that ability to balance because there's no idea of both original sin and of especially a personal grace, right? Not just a sort of general providence in the world, but the idea that God is intimately involved in the lives of individuals, groups of people, and so on.
Yeah. So, yeah, instead of dualism, Christianity offers, if I could once again use a kind of a Lutheran expression, a simultaneity, both at the same time.
Yeah, that's a much better word. Anything else you want to mention out of these lectures? Otherwise, I want to talk just briefly about some of the other essays in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, kind of emphasizing again that Cochrane's good on how grace works itself out in politics, and that's always what I'm pushing for people to see and draw from him, is that particularly in our when we often approach politics as Christians from a negative lens, we're really worried about the limits of politics, and that is hugely important. We do need to talk about the limits of politics, but that most people, when they enter into that conversation, if all they're hearing is the negative, that things are broken, that the world is sinful, that it's not very satisfying for them. And so what's particularly wonderful about, right, making sure we're including grace is that we're including hope. Right. I mean, you know, I like to compare Cochrane in many ways to, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr as contemporary. And, you know, Niebuhr is revered and respected and, you know, is this kind of, you know, major figure in this movement of Christian realism. But there's not a lot of hopefulness in Niebuhr, I would argue. I mean, he's sort of stuck in his category of, you know, moral man and immoral society. That, you know, we have this unutterable dichotomy. You know, there's some truth, but without the conversation about grace, there's not a lot of hope in that. Then it's sort of depressing. And so Cochrane, while in no way being, you know, kind of enthusiastic and, naive in thinking that everything can be made wonderful, you know, returns again to that Augustinian insight that, you know, the city of God will come and there will be perfect peace and perfect justice. And we participate in the kingdom, through the church, in the here and now, but that the future, you know, it will be fully realized. And so there is hope, even in the midst of, you know, the great, you know, what he called distractions of his age in terms of, you know, worldwide, conflict and depression.
Right. Yeah. It would have been interesting had he lived, not even that much longer, right, into the Cold War, which I suspect affected some of Niebuhr's pessimism. You know, the threat of nuclear war does affect people in the 50s and 60s in a way that it's hard for us to remember now. I don't see any indication that Cochrane would have gone that more negative direction, but it still would have been interesting to have those responses. The other essays in the volume, we won't spend as much time on them, both because they're shorter, and because with a couple of exceptions, they tend to be on some diverse topics. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I am sort of curious why you picked the essays you picked. Presumably, you had more to choose from.
Yeah. So yes and no. Right. On the one hand, you know, I was really focusing on those things that you know, he had put effort into and sort of more polished examples of his writing. The major ones were in fact published in his lifetime, but were published in minor journals that are hard in the, you know, say the 30s, that are hard for people to come across now. And so wanted to have a chance to sort of collect those together now. The Machiavelli piece was in a polished form, but he had not published it. So that really, you know, kind of led to that one's inclusion. I'm trying to give, you know, I also say accessible about his work because I am trying to give pictures of, you know, his thought on kind of some related, but, you know, a spectrum of topics, right? And so the Latin literature piece really does, talk about some of the more, things like satire and, you know, some of the plays, other things that people don't normally, you know, think of when they're thinking of, the politics of Rome. The Machiavelli piece shows, you know, him, his concern with, you know, future versions of classicism returning as, a perspective, because Machiavelli is so influenced by the ancient world and the construction he puts on the ancient world. And then the Gibbon piece, is both about, right, the period of the decline of the Roman Empire, but it's also about the 18th century and, right, Gibbon's thought, and his sort of indebtedness to skeptical, you know, rationalism of the 18th century. There are some other things, and maybe one of these days I might, you know, bring out some of his other writings that have not really been published. For now, these ones were the sort of polished gems that best demonstrate Cochrane's thinking, and so that's why they were included.
Yeah, and again, I'll encourage people to pick this up and read it. If one of these essays is going to sort of stick in people's craw and get a lot of pushback, it's going to be the one on Machiavelli. And I told you we wouldn't go into a lot of detail on this, so we won't. But can you give us sort of an overview of what is he saying about Machiavelli, other than he's just Machiavelli is bringing back sort of the classical view? What way does Cochrane think he's bringing it back?
Yeah, I want to be careful too a little on the Machiavelli essay because, though it was published, he did choose never to. Though it was not published, it was polished. He never chose to bring it out in a publication in his lifetime. The context is somewhat important here, and I mean, he's looking at this period. This is written in the late 20s, early 30s. He's looking at this. He's looking at the rise of Mussolini in Italy, and this reverence being given to Machiavelli. And he, on the one hand, is actually, appreciative of some things about Machiavelli. He appreciates part of the realism of Machiavelli, and he emphasizes in his mind, Machiavelli's much more strongly in the Republican camp. He's not just trying to train future dictators and things like that. And so he sort of emphasizes that part of him. But it's also a transitional piece for Cochrane because, Cochrane had to, I mean, his first book is on Thucydides. He actually, wasn't spending that much time thinking about Christianity until a certain point in his life. And that's when he started, he's really struck by how Augustine makes sense of everything eventually. So, he kind of ends the Machiavelli piece talking about the need to, the future needs to be a return and reconsideration of, the claims of Machiavelli's realism versus what the Christian tradition can offer. You have to be careful about, just kind of reading him and saying, oh, he thinks Machiavelli was wonderful and that he's a great authority. He's somewhat a little bit more, ambivalent, neither condemning him strongly, but also, saying that Christianity is going to offer more. I mean, that's really his big hit in Christian and classical culture when he returns and mentions Machiavelli in footnotes and things like that. He most often compares him to Julian the Apostate and shows that both of them have the same problem. And that is the problem of imagination, that they really imagine that they could live the lives of their grandfathers return to some golden age of the past when that's really not, ironically realistic. They think of themselves as realists, but they actually do, suffer in their imagination.
Yeah, and it's an interesting approach to Machiavelli. If nothing else, because he's coming at Machiavelli from the perspective primarily of the discourses rather than of the prints, which that never happens for many, many reasons, not least of which the discourses is much longer and more obscure than the prints. But again, it's an interesting essay, and I'll encourage listeners to go pick it up and read it. The other essays in here that we've already talked a little bit about Gibbon. Anything you want to add on the Gibbon essay?
Yeah, I mean, so the Gibbon essay is so fantastic, particularly in its conclusion, because sort of what it's signaling to us, right? That Cochrane is really good, as we've kind of said, about not looking at the decline and fall through a sort of singular explanation in terms of material or economics or conflict or something like that, but focusing on, right, you might say, the worldview that exists. He does the same thing for Gibbon, right? And he's demonstrating that this skeptical rationalism, which can only look at material causes, is going to be problematic for us, right? And so he really calls out in a somewhat implicit way, though it's there. He calls out, the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution as saying, yeah, you've accomplished these great material things, But you're going to get yourselves into trouble. I mean, he says, he says that we should realize that this is a game that others can play. And he's really referring to the Nazis, and saying that, you know, technology can be used by bad people, as well as by, you know, good people. And so, that scientific rationalism on its own is never going to be able to, you know, satisfy the human life and human desires.
Yeah. And again, I thought it was just an excellent engaging, with Gibbon. The one limitation that I thought his essays on Gibbon had, and maybe he gets to this in Christianity and Classical Culture. It's been so long since I've read it. I don't remember now. But he never engages Gibbon's substantive arguments, about the decline and fall of Rome. So he never tackles, you know, what Gibbon has to say about, you know, Christianity caused the fall of Rome, because you have these Christians out there who are leeching, you know, all of the virtuous and all of the hardworking and all of the competent people. Basically what I'm saying is the problem is it wasn't longer.
Yeah. So if you're thinking that it can be one of those things where it's like, well, instead of reading Gibbon, I'll read somebody, you know, talking about Gibbon so that I'll get both. Yeah, he's not an example of that. There's very few, you know, kind of not that many quotations directly from, so that you kind of feel like you're getting a summary of Gibbon along. It could have probably been a lot longer. He did publish it, but it began originally as lectures that he delivered at Princeton University, actually, in the early 1940s. And so there could have been a lot more said. He's really critiquing Gibbon's approach to the material, as opposed to just, you know, his arguments in detail.
Well, the other essay I wanted to briefly chat about, so the essay is on Classical Idea of the Commonwealth, Pax Romana, and Caesarism. Those are all excellent. Again, happy to commend those. But those are also tied to, at least from what I understand, they are tied to the arguments of Christianity and Classical Culture. So I think those can be read in conjunction with that book. Is that fair?
Yeah. So actually, they were originally intended to, as I can see it and best I can make out in from the archival sources and from, you know, my historical investigations to his life that I'm currently working on. They were originally meant to be the first three chapters of Christian Classical Culture that had to be cut out from the manuscript because, you know, the manuscript itself was already so long, and so it was sort of summed up in many ways. And it really, they're helpful to be considered as more detail and color to Christian Classical Culture. So, I mean, just even that idea of the classical idea of the Commonwealth as a concept and a phrase is repeated throughout Christian Classical Culture in the early sections. What it was originally the first chapter to sort of fully explain what it was, and he just for the sake of time had to sort of, you know, work it into the remainder of the text. But putting it firmly in focus wasn't possible for that manuscript. So it really is his effort to try to say that that's the definitive feature that makes all of classicism, you know, unified. That, I mean, a hit against Cochrane would be that he oversimplifies because, you know, you're treating this massive amount of material from ancient Greece and Rome as sort of all under one rubric. And there's some validity to that, right? I mean, we live in an age of scholarship where you're going to focus on just the Stoics or just the Cynics or just the Atomists or something like that. And there can be some good things that come from that level of specialization and detail. But, you know, what's great about him is that he's able to kind of use a synthetic brush and unify all the material. You know, the argument is that what really defines all of classicism as a unity is its vision that we can live together in community and, you know, reach a form of perfection in this life through our, you know, political, right, means and, you know, our end. So That's where that chapter came from, and the other ones kind of just build up talking more about the civil and social wars and, you know, the rise of factions within Rome that led to Caesar and Augustus. So they're great historical material, but and good in its own right, but better in some ways that Christian and classical culture, you know, got to the point a little faster.
Right. Yeah, and again, that's not to say these shouldn't be read, even though, like you said, it's they exist in well, not seed form, summary form, right, in Christianity and classical culture. The other essay in this book that stands sort of alone is the Latin spirit in literature. What is the Latin spirit in literature? I'm tempted to say, is it just kind of a boring spirit? Because I, at least when I think of Latin literature, aside from Virgil, I don't really think of page turners.
Yeah, so
I think you got to go to the Greeks for that. But yeah. Where am I wrong?
Yeah, well, so you know what he's actually emphasizing there is he's trying to demonstrate, right, that you can actually look at the Latin literature as a consistent unified thing, right? And why we have trouble with Cochrane these days is in many ways is fitting him into a disciplinary camp. I mean, you had that problem when you were trying to introduce him at the beginning of the discussion. Where does he fit? Because he does, you know, classical, you know, concern with literature and philology and things like that. He also does history. He does theology. He does philosophy. You know, everything is sort of together. And that's his contribution in many ways is to break down those walls, right? And so the Latin spirit of literature, he's actually showing that Augustine should be read as part of the Latin literature tradition, even though he's a church father, just as much as, you know, Juvenal and Cicero or somebody like that. But what is the Latin spirit? It's a spirit of construction, right? It's a practicality. It is a rootedness. Focus on building and practically possessing and things like that, and that has problems, right? There can be bad things come out of that, but it's also, you know, a way of reminding ourselves that because, you know, Western Latin Christianity, right, shares in this, is that we're concerned with an actual city of God and not, you know, some, you know, abstract idea that might exist maybe somewhere, sometime, that there is actual practicalities here. And so, you know, the Romans are mindful of that practicality, and we have to hold that tension as well, or else we, you know, risk becoming otherworldly in our faith. So, you know, that's the Latin spirit, is that concreteness.
Well, and that also explains why I, at least, and maybe this doesn't apply to others, have some trouble reading so much of the Roman literature, because it is so concrete and particular to their time, right? Certainly have, you know, a philosophy of history in Tacitus or in Suetonius or in the other Roman historians, but you don't have the extended discussion of it the same way you get in Thucydides or Herodotus. They're not as concerned with the big picture arc of world history. They're much more concerned with what happened on this day and what's the series of events. And that stuff is important, but in some ways it's akin to reading the congressional record. Right. It matters, but that's not what makes that's not what makes a best-selling novel.
Yeah. No, it's a fair, you know, it's a fair critique. But you know, I think that Cochrane in many ways is a fantastic, you know, way to look at all of that that Roman literature. I'm of course highly recommend primary sources to anyone, but Cochrane's a fantastic kind of field guide to those primary sources, as opposed to maybe just diving in and you know, being put off by the initial reception.
Right. All right. Well, I think we've talked about at least briefly every essay in this book. Anything you'd like to add? Anything you'd like our listeners to hear about the book, about Cochrane, life in general?
Yeah.
What do you got?
Cochrane is just a sorely neglected figure because, you know, people kind of don't know what to do with him. And, you know, I want people to, you know, remember him and, you know, start taking him seriously again. I mean, that's really, it's been animating my project for, you know, a long time now. I brought out his posthumous writings as a way to try to say, you know, this is stuff that needs to see the light of day. And I'm currently at work on a biography of his life, which I, on, you know, will certainly hope will, once again, you know, remind people about him, but also, you know, helpfully contextualize him. One of my critiques on Cochrane be that he didn't write introductions as well as he should have. I mean, the introductions to his books are usually, you know, like a page, couple pages or something like that, and it really misses a lot of the context that would be helpful for us as readers to be able to really understand what's going on in these things. And so, you know, my work in a lot of ways is trying to contextualize his writings so that people can understand the main outlines of the arguments and their historical importance and things like that. So I'm working on a biography of his life at present that I hope will be out in the coming years. And so I really, you know, want to kind of be as an evangelist for Cochrane, because Cochrane is so good at reminding us of, you know, the Augustinian tradition within Christianity and its, you know, vibrancy and relevancy still for us today.
And just to clarify, your criticism of Cochrane is that his books aren't long enough.
Yeah, that would be true.
All right. And I think I agree with you, having read at least one of his books. I could have used more of it. Well, thank you again, Dr. Beer, for joining us on the City of Man podcast. And thank you, listeners, for joining us as well. The City of Man podcast is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. If you have comments or questions, please feel free to post them on the show notes at christianhumanist.org or email them to us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com or comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Be sure to go out and pick up a copy of Augustine and the Problem of Power, edited by David Beer. And as always, remember to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.